The Tom Woods Show, episode 1284.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, with its incredible reviews and customer satisfaction, Casper is becoming the internet's favorite mattress. Get $50 towards select mattresses by visiting casper.com/woods and using promo code Woods at checkout. Terms and conditions apply. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. Michael Bolden is our guest today. He is the founder and executive director of the 10th Amendment Center, and he came up with the idea for this episode. You may have heard that the acting attorney general has said things favorable to the idea of state nullification, and he is 100% correct about this historically and in every other way, constitutionally, strategically, morally. By the way, that's why I wrote a book called Nullification back in 2010. You can grab that on Amazon. I'll link to it on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/1284. If you haven't yet signed up for Audible, you can get my nullification book in Audible form for free through tomwoodsaudio.com. Anyway, in particular, what Michael and I thought we would talk about today is the lost history of Northern resistance to the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 and to the fugitive slave laws more generally, but particularly that Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, because they could make some kind of constitutional argument against it, despite the existence of the Fugitive Slave Clause of the Constitution. Well, anyway, it goes beyond the personal liberty laws that people are familiar with. There's a lot going on here, and the language of nullification and state sovereignty was used by these people to fight against slavery. So as usual, the story turns out to be something like the opposite of what you heard in school. Michael, welcome to the show.
So good to be here, Tom.
Great seeing you not so long ago on the pre-Contra Cruise party. That was fun. Too bad you couldn't join us on the cruise this year, but, you know, there will be other cruises. That's all I can say at the moment, but always fun to see you guys, given that you guys live on the other end of the country. It's not that often that I get to see you, so that was a treat.
I was sad to not be with everybody this year, but it was so cool to create the first annual Contra Cruise pre-party.
The pre-party was fantastic.
It was really, really good.
It was so great that you made the drive to San Diego to be there.
To be an advertisement for the cruise,
absolutely,
which I am all the time, I tell you, you know, there is nothing like being locked on a boat with 100 or so people who get every joke about sound money you can think about. Everybody's like chuckling all the time. I mean, you make these bonds with people that I hadn't seen in over in a year. And the first thing is it's like hugs, and people are telling Sarah, who had never met her before, like, I feel like I know you through Facebook. And you create these bonds. It really is a family. And to me, that is the best part of it. And I'm grateful to have been a part of it last year.
Absolutely. Well, for anybody who's confused, the Contra Cruise is named after Contra Krugman, the podcast I do with Bob Murphy every week. And we've done three cruises, and so far they've all just been fantastic. Everybody loves them. We'll be announcing the 2019 cruise very soon. I will say one of my favorite moments was during the Freedom Feud game this year. The question, we surveyed 100 people. We're going to do it just like the regular show. And the question was, name the best guest ever on the Tom Woods Show. So Michael Malice has now gone even farther into the lead than in the past. He's way number one. So they're going, now it's Jeff Deist's team's turn, and they get one more, they get a chance to steal. They can just come up with one final guess, and their guess is wrong, so they lose the round. And it turns out one of the names that, if they had guessed it, would have gotten the points was Jeff Deist.
Oh, awesome.
If he had only said his own name.
I saw you post that on Twitter. I hadn't watched it yet. Did you post that one?
I did, and we don't do any formal recordings of anything on the cruise, because the idea is if you're not there, you don't get to see it. But Naomi Brockwell did like a somewhat amateur kind of recording. Like, she didn't have a microphone going through a board or anything, but she did set up a camera and was able to capture it. So you can watch our Freedom Feud game, and it was a lot of fun. All right, anyway, this is way too long of a buildup to what we're trying to talk about today. I thought we would talk today about a topic that you suggested. You texted me. I said, yep, this is a good one. And in particular, it's timely because of this whole acting attorney general, is it Whitaker? I'm not even following it.
Right, Whitaker.
Yeah, that he's pro-nullification. And as well he should be, because all the evidence is in favor of it, so there's nothing wrong with that. Although all the law school people are all telling him, that's wrong, I didn't learn this in law school. I mean, it just goes to remind you that, as Kevin Guzman says, don't ever confuse legal training with an education. So I'm going to have an episode tomorrow where I'll go through and address this whole matter of is this guy crazy to believe in nullification or not? But anything that makes the establishment go berserk, I just have a knee-jerk support for. So you wanted to talk in particular about the completely neglected history of Northerners who, not for the first time, made use of the ideas of nullification and the principles of 1798, of course, the year of the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions, but in particular focusing specifically on abolitionism and slavery. So, because that is the opposite of the comic book story that we get. It was stupid Southerners who wanted to enslave people, and that's why they want to nullify federal laws. Of course, there aren't any anti-slavery federal laws for them to nullify. And I might also mention before I stop talking that I just put on Twitter an excerpt from Jefferson Davis's farewell address to the Senate, where he comes right out and says, now look, you know, there are a lot of people who favor nullification, the idea that the state can stay in the Union while not living up to its constitutional obligation to enforce the law. Let me tell you, that is not my theory at all. So again, I just love living in reality where things are so much more textured and interesting than in the comic book world these jerks want us to live in. So, all right, where do you want to start this story?
Oh, man, there is so much good to go on. And really, I got interested in studying this a few years ago, reading your incredible article, The States' Rights Tradition That Nobody Knows. And you wrote this early on talking about how nullification was not, as they all like to say, this tool of the slavers. And in fact, even though I would make the case that this guy Whitaker really doesn't support nullification, it is just propaganda and using it as a tool to set up the argument that nullification is a tool of slave owners and therefore Trump is bad because he has this guy here. Now, mind you, Whitaker says that he said specifically as a principle that nullification was turned down by the courts and the federal government hasn't recognized it. So therefore, he's really setting the stage for, what are you talking about? Like, nullification can't be used, or maybe we could try it, but, well, the courts are against us. The whole point of nullification is that the courts are against us, and the federal government doesn't approve it, and that's why we have to nullify things. But, of course, the article, Andrew Kaczynski, and then I saw you had responded to a tweet from some legal expert over at CNN, Renato Mariotti, talking about how nullification was an argument made by Southerners prior to the Civil War, who believed their states could nullify federal laws, and therefore it was crushed in a losing case in a war against the North. And the implication there was that nullification was used to support slavery, and they lost, and therefore don't talk about it. It's bad. It's evil. But the fact of the matter is that nullification was used by Northern states to go after the Federal Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. And the one thing that really led me to it was simply reading the South Carolina Declaration of Causes. This was a document they put together with their Ordinance of Secession. And it said this, and I'm going to read this. It says, quote, the states of Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rhode Island, New York, Pennsylvania, Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Iowa have enacted laws which either nullify the acts of Congress, that is the Fugitive Slave Act, or render useless any attempt to execute them. So I don't know, was that like 10, 12 states? I went to government school, so my math is bad. I can't imagine the idea of nullification being used as a tool of slavery when all these northern states were nullifying things that the slave owners were actually supporting, and that is the Fugitive Slave Act.
And just as with the kinds of things you talk about today with the 10th Amendment Center, there are different levels of resistance that we see in this case. Just as with today, there are some states that just go full-blown, we're going to resist the federal government head-on, to we're going to make the federal government's life a little bit more difficult than it might otherwise be. And you and I, being liberally-minded people, we want to have a broad definition of nullification. I include all those sorts of things in my definition. And the same thing is true here. Not every case was, we are absolutely going to defy every aspect of the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850.
Well, and I like to get my strategy right from Thomas Jefferson. November 10th, 1798, 220 years ago this past Saturday, the Kentucky House passed resolutions drafted in secret by Jefferson against the Alien and Sedition Acts, formalizing the principles of nullification. After it was signed by the governor on November 16th, one day later, he was all excited. He sent a letter to his friend James Madison with a copy of the resolves, and he said, you know, we should hold to these principles all the time, every principle, important principle they contain. But we should also not be pushed to extremities and push things as far as events will render prudent. So good strategy. A great strategist like Thomas Jefferson told us, look at the situation on the ground and find ways to defeat these things. And sometimes, like you said, that means going full bore and addressing the whole thing. And sometimes that means undermining parts of it. And I think the important thing we should discuss then is what was the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850? Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, the short version, tried to make everyone in the North into a slave catcher for the South. It basically denied any person accused of being a slave any semblance of due process. A white man could go and say, this black person is my property. And then it would go in front of a commissioner, and the commissioner would get paid $10 if he held in on the side of the so-called slave owner, and he would get paid $5 if he set the person free. So the people in the South, and in fact, on top of it, the law itself says that any testimony of the alleged fugitive slave could never be admitted in evidence. So people in the North, and Lysander Spooner actually put together a really interesting document on this, on even the constitutionality of slavery and how states could take on the Fugitive Slave Act. But many people in the North, legal experts, actually opposed the constitutionality of the Fugitive Slave Act and took action to resist it. So again, whether it was states like Vermont passing the Habeas Corpus Act, which allowed habeas corpus and evidence in court or in these hearings in defiance of the federal act, or the people of Ohio who actually arrested a federal marshal and his agents in the famous Oberlin-Wellington case where they protected someone against the Federal Fugitive Slave Act there.
So what I've got, it turns out I've got a few pages about this in my book, Nullification. I knew it was in there, but when I went back to look at it, I wrote this book 8 years ago. Went back to look at it, I thought, hey, there's more than I thought. I forgot all this stuff. This is pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
This book ain't so bad. So it was things like, I remembered, just because I've given speeches on this, that they would do things like make clear that federal officials could not use local jails if they wanted to house accused fugitives. Or they would punish state officials who were collaborating with the Fugitive Slave Act. So they
Massachusetts was famous on this. Michigan was famous on this. Massachusetts, actually, if you were licensed in the state as an attorney and you represented a slave catcher in a fugitive slave case, you'd get disbarred. You could not use jails. These are basic ways that we talk about nullifying and undermining federal acts today. It's an effective strategy. And we know that in places like the Northeast, where it was very strong resistance, they called Syracuse the great central depot of the Underground Railroad. And the hated Daniel Webster came there to in 1851 or so to say how they were going to enforce this Fugitive Slave Act no matter what, even here in the midst of the next anti-slavery convention. But in the Northeast, the last person that was captured and returned to the South, at least recorded, was Anthony Burns in 1854 in Boston. But it was very effective at stopping this. And the president himself, Millard Fillmore, who I absolutely despise, an editorial in the Memphis Daily Eagle in late 1850, shortly after Vermont passed her Habeas Corpus Act, it was reported that the Fillmore administration was threatening to invade Vermont over the nullification crisis. The article was called "The Administration and Nullifying Vermont." So how can you say that nullification was used to support slavery? And we have article after article after article. We've done research, Mike Meharry and I, over the last few years, looking up the historical record on this. Virginia Governor John Floyd condemned Vermont in a speech for her nullification of the Fugitive Slave Act. The New Orleans Bee put out an article talking about Vermont's vile theories of nullification. This was all over the country, this evil nullification happening in the Northeast. But it was very effective by simply saying you can't use these resources. Well, where are they going to hold them? They did not have federal fugitive slave facilities. So with the state simply said, we're not going to participate, there was nothing they could do.
It's almost as if our opponents are not that familiar with Millard Fillmore.
Well, they're either really ignorant. I personally think...
I just wanted to say the name Millard Fillmore. I don't think it's ever been said on this show in 1,284 episodes.
Twice in a minute. So I personally think that most people are complete idiots on this era. They just simply haven't studied any of it. They don't know what the hell they're talking about. And does that mean that Andrew Kaczynski and this Mariotti guy are just ignorant or stupid? Maybe. They could be total liars. I mean, we've run a kind of a tweet storm at Mariotti. So if he looks at his notifications and he saw any of ours, he'll know that it was the anti-slavery abolitionists like John Greenleaf Whittier, the famous poet who said that in regards to the Fugitive Slave Act, he was, quote, "I am a nullifier." Or Walt Whitman, who wrote a poem called A Caution, he said, "The states should resist much and obey little." So this was a popular view. It wasn't necessarily a dominant one, but it was very popular and very common. And the fact that South Carolina and then also Mississippi, Texas, and I believe Georgia in their declarations of causes to secede also cited Northern nullification of the Fugitive Slave Act as one of the reasons for leaving the Union.
All right. I love stuff like this. I mean, this is, in a nutshell, what you and I love doing.
I geek out on this all the time. I mean, you got me going on this, talking about the Joshua Glover story. And remember, we did that great event in Cincinnati at the...
It was the Underground Railroad Center. It had a Harriet Tubman auditorium or theater in it.
Yes.
And that's where we had it. It was fantastic.
Yes. And to hear the story about the resistance in Wisconsin, where the state Supreme Court took the position that they were nullifying the Federal Fugitive Slave Act. I have one of the quotes here handy. "Resolved, this assumption of jurisdiction by the federal judiciary in the said case and without process is an act of undelegated power and therefore without authority, void, and of no force." That could have been written by Thomas Jefferson back in 1798.
Well, I think the Wisconsin Supreme Court more or less did either the, let's see, let me see. You know, it was the Wisconsin legislature issued a resolution in support of the Wisconsin Supreme Court. But let's go back a couple steps here and let's tell people who Joshua Glover was. Then we can celebrate what Wisconsin did, because the state Supreme Court of Wisconsin just came right out and said that the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 is unconstitutional, void, and of no force. Now, first of all, I might also point out that I can understand why somebody, just a pure constitutionalist looking at this, may say, we may not like the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, but there is, after all, a fugitive slave clause in the Constitution. So maybe here you can make only a moral argument and not a constitutional one. But there were, you know, whether you accept them or not, there were constitutional arguments being made by abolitionists and opponents of this act at that time. So first of all, they felt like the fact that the accused fugitives were not being given a proper jury trial, which in effect meant that—
No Fifth Amendment.
Yeah, they were in effect being kidnapped, potentially. Yes. They could just be any old person being taken out of the state.
The Michigan personal liberty law was an act against kidnapping.
Yeah, that's exactly, that was how they framed it, is that a state has an obligation to protect its citizens against kidnapping. And then also, the Fugitive Slave Act was claimed to have the authority to make bystanders assist in capturing fugitives and things like this. But then if you want to be really nitpicky, the Constitution requires that judicial officers must be paid by fixed salaries. But the fugitive slave commissioners were not paid by fixed salaries. They were paid by fees. And as it turns out, they were paid in variable fees. If you return the accused fugitive to slavery, you get $10. If you set him free, you only get $5. There's a certain bias built into the system.
What's that adjusted for inflation? You have any guess? What would you guess?
I have no idea.
I mean,
whatsoever.
I think I couldn't it was even significant. Speculate. It was significant and it was double. I mean, think of somebody who's in this position. Oh, it sent 50, 60 people. And the story, 12 years of a slave, really is a Fugitive Slave Act story. This is about a person who was born free that was caught up in this system and thrown into bondage in the South. And many people were caught up in this. Not that I would ever make the argument that any human being would own anybody, but just in case Think Progress is listening, it's important to mention that. And even under the idea that slavery was constitutional, Spooner thought it wasn't, and that the Fugitive Slave Act could be enacted in some way, the fact that someone could not even present their case in a court or in a hearing is totally a violation of that person's rights. They're basically just putting it up to some dude. Okay, this guy says you're his property. Okay, you lose. And that's the case that people made in the North, that unless you could have a proper trial, habeas corpus, then there was no way they were going to support it.
So what can you tell us about specifically? Let's talk about the case of Joshua Glover and what happened to him.
Oh, man. So I grew up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where in downtown Milwaukee, and I used to walk by this all the time. I had no idea what it was, but there's a historical marker in the middle of the city talking about the rescue of Joshua Glover.
I actually didn't know that.
Yeah. I'm sure it's probably on the wiki page. You didn't know the Milwaukee part or the...
Yeah, I didn't know that there was this monument.
Yeah, there's an actual monument right in the middle of downtown Milwaukee that says the rescue of Joshua Glover. And it's basically on the site. Well, short version, he escaped slavery in Missouri, made his way up to Racine, Wisconsin, which is right between Chicago and Milwaukee. And the former slave owner, this guy, Garland, I think it was, he tried to use the Fugitive Slave Act to recover him. Glover was captured, taken to a jail, but a whole mob that was kind of brought together by a good newspaper man, Sherman Booth. They broke him out. He then escaped to Canada via the Underground Railroad. But then there was this whole case. The feds came in on these people and tried to go after them. And that's where what you were talking about, Tom, the legislature passed a resolution. And then the state Supreme Court in 1859 said that the feds were in the wrong on this.
And the way they said it was just amazing. I mean, they were very uncooperative the whole time. So they really dilly-dallied about getting a proper record of the case over to the U.S. Supreme Court. This went on for years. So the whole thing started in 1854. It wasn't until 1857 that the U.S. attorney was finally able to get a copy of that record. And again, late 1858, the U.S. Supreme Court ordered that Booth be turned over to federal custody. Again, the state Supreme Court refused to comply. And again, if you read the statement in support of its state Supreme Court by the legislature of Wisconsin, it's drawn right out of Jefferson and nullification. Can I read one? I want to read one passage.
Yeah, please.
No, it's folks.
So good.
This is actually now from something different. Several weeks after Glover was captured, there was a handbill circulated announcing the establishment of the, quote, anti-slave catchers mass convention. And here's the language used on that handbill. This is 1859 in Wisconsin. All the people of this state who are opposed to being made slaves or slave catchers and to having the free soil of Wisconsin made the hunting ground for human kidnappers, and all who are willing to unite in a state league to defend our state sovereignty, our state courts, and our state and national constitutions against the flagrant usurpations of U.S. judges, commissioners, and marshals and their attorneys, and to maintain inviolate those great constitutional safeguards of freedom, the writ of habeas corpus and the right of trial by jury, as old and sacred as constitutional liberty itself, and all who are willing to sustain the cause of those who are prosecuted and to be prosecuted in Wisconsin by the agents and executors of the Kidnapping Act of 1850. I love how they call it the Kidnapping Act of 1850. For the alleged crime of rescuing a human being from the hands of kidnappers and restoring him to himself and to freedom are invited to meet at such and such place. Now, that language about maintaining and defending our state sovereignty against the flagrant usurpations of U.S. judges. That's the kind of extreme language and irresponsible language that Think Progress would absolutely condemn you for today. Think Progress, for anybody listening who doesn't know, it's the Soros-funded thought control website that makes sure that we don't think about things like this. I'm reading you a passage from my book, Nullification. I quote from that handbill in my book. But this is the kind of thing that happens with Think Progress. They never once, they attacked me for years over my book, never once quoted one word. And I'm not joking. Not one word quoted from the book, because the book is very, very persuasive. I mean, I have to say, this book makes a very convincing case. So not one word quoted from it. But you notice that the language that the 10th Amendment Center uses was used here word for word to support runaway slaves. That's important.
Yeah, and you know, and people have read your book. They know the Glover story. They know this from reading our work. They know this from the Nullify Now Cincinnati event. Not tons of people, but there are many cases like this. One of the other ones that we highlighted was a similar case about an escaped former, I hate using the word slave, but, you know, in quotes, this is someone who was someone's property at some time, John Price. And I mentioned it briefly. He escaped to Oberlin, Ohio, where he was arrested by a federal marshal. But this was an anti-slavery hotspot as well. And so they ended up breaking him out because the marshal was hiding him in some motel room. They broke him out, got him to freedom. Well, the people of Ohio then arrested the federal agent and all of his deputies, and it created a negotiation because the federal government came in and arrested 27 people and charged them. And so what happened was there was kind of a trade-off, and it created a situation where the feds had to back down. They released 25 of the 27 in response to Ohio releasing the federal agents. And the last two that went to a jury trial only got short prison sentences of like 20 and 60 days each. So this shows how when you create a scenario that becomes difficult for the federal government logistically and politically, you can really get them to back down.
Michael, just a quick sponsored message. We were talking about the Contra Cruise earlier. And this year on the cruise, so many people came up to me and said, I bought a Casper mattress and I've never been so comfortable. I absolutely love it. Bob Murphy, who co-hosts the cruise with me and the Contra Krugman podcast, also ordered a Casper mattress and loves it. I ordered one for my daughter, Regina, and she loves it. It's an amazing product. You spend one third of your life sleeping, so you should be comfortable. And the Casper mattress is designed to mimic human curves, so it provides supportive comfort for all kinds of bodies. The original Casper mattress combines multiple supportive memory foams for a quality sleep surface with the right amounts of both sink and bounce. And its breathable design helps you sleep cool and regulates your body temperature throughout the night. Free shipping and returns in the U.S. and Canada, and you can be sure of your purchase with Casper's 100-night risk-free sleep-on-it trial. Get $50 towards select mattresses by visiting casper.com/woods and using promo code WOODS at checkout. That's $50 towards select mattresses at casper.com/woods when you use promo code WOODS at checkout. Terms and conditions apply. I'd like you to move off this topic for a minute and talk to us a bit about an Abbeville Institute event that you attended with other friends of this program as a speaker just in the past several days. And I want to know about what you said and then how you or anybody else there were portrayed by the Think Progress reporter who was there. And again, remember everybody, the purpose of Think Progress is to control thought. It is not to... And you think I'm exaggerating or I'm being dramatic.
No, they are the worst.
That is why they're there. It is to control thought. And so there's no way they're going to accurately describe what Michael said, even though they probably know that people could get access to Michael's talk, so they could easily find out that the Think Progress people are distorting things. But they're willing to roll the dice on that. So talk to us about that.
For years, Tom, for people who don't know, you and I, we have run into these nasty people. And sometimes I'll call them clowns, but I think that diminishes them. They are not incapable. They have tens of millions of dollars behind them from the Center of American Progress. And they go out of their way to quote people out of context if they quote them at all, to make sure that they fit a certain narrative that if you aren't on Team American Progress, which is just such a misuse of the phrase, then you're clearly the bad person. And they've gone after you aggressively for so many years. And I would run into reporters years ago and they'd be like, oh, hey, there's that friend. You're friends with that Woods guy, huh? And honest to God, this has happened to me many times. But what they use as a tactic, mind you, I've been in the mainstream media, CBS News, Reuters, AP, US News, New York Times, LA Times. Every single time one of these people talks to me, if it's in person, they hand me a card or they say their name. They say, I am so-and-so. I'm reporting with the New York Times. Can I ask you a few questions? Well, what does Think Progress do? And it's the same approach, no matter who it is, no matter what year it is. They walk up to you right after your speech and like, oh, hey, man, that was pretty awesome, acting like your buddy. Oh, by the way, I'm a reporter. What do you think about blah, blah, blah? And that's what they did to me at the end of the Abbeville Institute, which was last Saturday, November 10th, the anniversary of the Kentucky House passing Jefferson's resolutions against the Alien and Sedition Acts. And he asked me some question about this Whitaker guy. I'm like, I don't know. All these people are awful. Jeff Sessions was garbage. And maybe Rudy Giuliani, whoever's next, going to be garbage. Oh, by the way, who do you write for? And he says, oh, I've written, you know, I do a bunch of stuff. Doesn't just ignores it. No, really, who do you write for? And he says, well, I've written for, I think he said Slate and somebody else. So he tells me who he's written for in the past. And I'm like, no, who are you writing for now? And he says to me, well, I'm writing for Think Progress. I'm like, Think Progress, your buddy Ian Millhiser there, who, if people want to look up, have attacked both Tom and I's work. You know, they don't like us. He doesn't like us. You guys have switched on war. What happened to you guys? Blah, blah, blah. The reason they do this is because they want to act like your friend and try to get you to say something. He was trying to get me to say something in support of the acting attorney general, even though I didn't know anything about what was going on, because he wants to paint me into a corner. Now, he quoted me in one statement. He quoted me saying, remember the 10th of November. Because I wanted people to remember the history of nullification as Thomas Jefferson talked about it back in those resolutions. He did not quote me talking about the principles and the strategy that we use to nullify in practice, even if not in law, the federal laws banning a plant. I spent 25 minutes giving the heroic tale of Angel Raich, who defied the Supreme Court. And even after she lost the Gonzalez versus Raich case, where Justice Scalia said growing six plants in your backyard, never crossing state lines with them, consuming in your own home and never buying or sell them was somehow interstate commerce, she actually said, you know what, I'm going to continue doing this and I'm going to help other people do this as well, even though the Supreme Court says otherwise. I told this heroic story of this woman who did this. I talked about how war is bad, all the bombs that are being dropped, no matter who's in there, opposing mass surveillance, federal forfeiture, things that people in the mainstream left might agree with us on. He didn't quote any of those things. I even talked about Hillary Clinton tweeting that states are the frontier to protect things that progressives believe in. I talked about Rosa Parks saying no. None of this made it into a report. What he did cover was, oh, there's a bunch of radical people talking about things that were proposed by racists and slave owners. It was proposed by these people. It was defeated in the Civil War, and therefore it is wrong. And then it was used again by Wallace and racist people in the 1950s. And that's all they put. And what they do is they go out of their way to tell a story that isn't true, because they don't want people learning about this. And before we started recording, I actually mentioned to you, Tom, and I think this is a good story to share as well. Once I found out there was this Think Progress guy, we did a Q&A session, and I talked about how Think Progress, actually, Ian Millhiser, the guy there, he actually wrote an article years ago to oppose our effort to nullify the NSA, to turn off the water to the Bluffdale facility in Utah, which we've covered on this show, because it might work. And that, if that isn't, to me, a green light to keep pushing forward, I don't know what is.
Yeah, that it's just laughable. It's not like they don't know what they're doing. The guy sat through what you said. And then the idea that, oh, this was used by bad people we don't like. So was the federal government far more often. The federal government itself, centralized power, has far more often been used for bad things. But it, at no time, if I were to say that to him and say, look, the federal government did X, Y, and Z, they'd say, well, look, you know, nobody's perfect. That would be their answer.
And then he wouldn't quote you as saying that.
Right.
So that,
yeah, right.
That is what I think is the greatest level of dishonesty. And in the past, I've had the New York Times talk to me and they send me an email after talking to me saying, this is what we're going to print. Is it out of context? That doesn't happen all the time, but it does happen from time to time, and even from publications that we might think are against us, because they're politically slanted, there's no doubt about it. At least some of the on-the-ground reporters are honest. This guy goes, and every person I've dealt with, many of them over the years, at Think Progress, they go out of their way with their $30 to $50 million of funding every year at Center for American Progress from George Soros, not to just try to make like a boogie monster, but this is a fact. This is the money there that's going on for a certain message. They go out of their way to not quote you saying anything that their supporters might want to hear. Well, good thing that enough of our message got to enough progressives on NSA surveillance when Barack Obama was in power that they actually had to go out of their way to say, don't do it. Here's why. Now, hopefully it didn't convince too many people, because we're going to continue wrapping that up and pushing it forward.
Well, that's good to hear, because that's one of the
reasons. I'm rambling a little bit. But
these people
really irritate me.
It's so absurd at this point. I can't even generate the outrage anymore, because I've followed these same people over the years. They write the same inane articles with the same arguments that they know we've answered a million times, but they figure the general public doesn't know that, so they can get away with it. I know that's how and why they're acting the way they are.
Yeah.
But I will say that your determination and your creativity, like the proposal to turn off the water in Utah to the NSA, which needs it to cool its computers, is, you know, it's a kind of nullification. And that's a great idea. None of these libertarian or conservative think tanks came up with anything like that. They keep soliciting donations, even though they've got tens of hundreds of millions of dollars. Imagine what Michael Bolton could do with hundreds of millions of dollars. Things would change in this country. And this is why I donate to the 10th Amendment Center. I think I give the 10th Amendment Center more than Okay. You're number two.
You're very generous, Tom.
Well,
I mean, I can't tell you. So on a monthly basis, how many people tell me, oh, I signed up as a member because I heard Tom talk to you and say he personally supports it. So there's something to that. When people listen to someone that they trust over and over, and that person that they trust says, I support these guys. So I can't even express to you how much help that's given us beyond even the very generous financial amount that you give every month. So thank you.
Well, it's my pleasure, because I know that there are people out there who want to do something. Of course, a lot of people want to volunteer, and I know that you're happy to have people help you out. But there are other people who don't have the time to volunteer, but they have a little bit of cash and they'd like to do something productive with it. And I say that helping out Michael Bolton and the 10th Amendment Center is one of the great outlets that you have. It's an excellent way to put that money to work. Because for one thing, Michael is not going to spend it on chauffeurs and fancy hotels. I know that Michael is extremely frugal and is very, very careful with how he spends that money, which again is not exactly something you can say about a lot of think tanks out there. I mean, your donation went to, you know, the half of somebody's $85 dinner. That was that's where your donation went, you know? So screw that. Help out the 10th Amendment Center. So tell people how they can find out more and contact you and give and everything else.
Well, we're actually, after this conversation, Tom, I'm actually building a new page dedicated to just this issue we've been talking about, tenthamendmentcenter.com/fugitiveslave, tenthamendmentcenter.com, all spelled out, /fugitiveslave. It will be live well before this show actually is posted. And then for anyone who wants to support us, of course, tenthamendmentcenter.com/donate. It's always hard for me to ask, but I can't tell you, nothing helps us get the word out more than the support of our donors, whether it's $2 a month or $2,000 or whatever it may be, and we make very good use of it. I want people to actually learn about this and spread the information to others more than anything.
Absolutely. Well, as I say, Michael, of course, as you know, couldn't be a bigger supporter, and I'm glad we had a chance to talk about this topic. It's a tantalizing look into something really, really important and overlooked. So definitely 10thamendmentcenter.com, right? 10th Amendment
slash, yeah,
/fugitiveslave. All right, so I'm going to link to that page in particular at tomwoods.com/1284, and I'll probably also link to my humble contribution to this conversation, namely the book Nullification. So that stuff will all be at tomwoods.com/1284. Well, thanks, Michael. Hope to see you soon.
Awesome, Tom. Thank you so much.
All right, folks, before I let you go, I want you to put something on your calendar. Get your Google Calendar out. By the way, I would not be able to live without Google Calendar. Honest to goodness, I don't know what I'm doing on any particular day if I haven't got that calendar. I'm telling you. In fact, I have missed things because I didn't put them on that calendar. If it's not on the calendar, it doesn't exist. It's not happening for me. So get your Google Calendar out and make sure that you jot down on Friday, November 23rd, that's Black Friday, the best deal of the year for web hosting. So I want to tell you about another person who used my link to get their hosting, and that is principledlibertarian.com, brand new, well, newish website, principledlibertarian.com. And what you'll read there are really, really good and provocative libertarian posts. So 10 books to make you a better libertarian. I haven't looked at them, by the way, yet. Maybe one of mine is in there, maybe not. I'm not going to prejudice the whole thing here by doing that. But minarchists and anarchists, are they on the same path? Or The Social Contract is Null and Void, or Private Justice During San Francisco's Gold Rush. A lot of really good, juicy stuff like this is waiting for you over there at principledlibertarian.com. I'll link to that at tomwoods.com/1284. And let me remind you, of course, that if you do get your hosting through my link, you get nice publicity like this, so there's some chance people will go to the site when you open it. Because that's your first struggle. When you first open a site, who's going to know it exists? I'll help you get over that hurdle and give you some other bonuses as well. But hold off, wait until Black Friday, because you are going to get the best price of the year on that day. So I would like you to save as much money as you can. So just make yourself a note that on Black Friday, on the 23rd of November, you're going to go get your web hosting. And you're going to go to tomwoods.com/publicity to find out about my bonuses and how you get them and how you get that web hosting. It's all going to be great. We're going to get a lot of people signing up on that day. And our domination of the internet will continue. Thanks for listening.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.